Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, chapter 13, text 42.
Yep.
Yata gavo nasi protas. Yata gavo nasi protas. Tanchambadas chadamabi. Vaktantyam nama birbada. Vaktantyam nama birbada. Bahanti balami situ. Bahanti balami situ. Yatagavo nasi protas. Tantyam badas chadamabi. Vaktantyam nama birbada. Bahanti balami situ.
Others, please.
Vaishnavis. Yataha, as much as, gaba, cow, nasi, by the nose, prota, strung, tantyam, by the thread, bada, bound by, cha, also, dhammabi, by ropes, vaktantyam, in the network of Vedic hymns. Namabhi, by nomenclatures. Bada, condition. Bahanti, carry on. Balim, orders. Isitu, for being controlled by the Supreme Lord. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. As a cow bound through the nose by a long rope is conditioned, so also human beings are bound by different Vedic injunctions and are conditioned to obey the orders of the Supreme. Purport. Every living being, whether a man or an animal or a bird, thinks he is free by himself. But actually, no one is free from the severe laws of the Lord. The laws of the Lord are severe because they cannot be disobeyed in any circumstance. The man-made laws may be evaded by cunning outlaws, but in the codes of the Supreme Lawmaker, there is not the slightest possibility of neglecting the laws. A slight change in the course of God-made law can bring about a massive danger to be faced by the lawbreaker. Such laws of the Supreme are generally known as the codes of religion under different conditions. But the principle of religion everywhere is one and the same, namely, obey the orders of the Supreme God, the codes of religion. That is the condition of material existence. All living beings in the material world have taken up the risk of conditioned life by their own selection and are thus entrapped by the laws of material nature. The only way to get out of the entanglement is to agree to obey the Supreme. But instead of becoming free from the clutches of Maya or illusion, foolish human beings become bound by different nomenclatures, being designated as Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishyas, Hindus, Mohammedans, Indians, Europeans, Americans, Chinese, and many others. And thus they carry out the orders of the Supreme Lord under the influence of respective scriptural or legislative injunctions. The statutory laws of the state are imperfect imitation replicas of religious codes. The secular state, or the godless state, allows the citizens to break the laws of God, but restricts them from disobeying the laws of the state. The result is that the people in general suffer more by breaking the laws of God than by obeying the imperfect laws made by man. Every man is imperfect by constitution under conditions of material existence, and there is not the least possibility that even the most materially advanced man can enact perfect legislation. On the other hand, there is no such imperfection in the laws of God. If leaders are educated in the laws of God, there is no necessity of a makeshift legislative council of aimless men. There is necessity of change in the makeshift laws of man, but there is no change in the God-made laws because they are made perfect by the all-perfect personality of Godhead. The codes of religion, scriptural injunctions, are made by liberated representatives of God in consideration of different conditions of living and by carrying out the orders of the Lord, the conditioned living beings gradually become free from the clutches of material existence. The factual position of the living being is, however, that he is the eternal servitor of the Supreme Lord. In his liberated state, he renders service to the Lord and in transcendental love, and thus enjoys a life of full freedom, even sometimes on an equal level with the Lord, or sometimes more than the Lord. But in the conditioned material world, every living being wants to be the Lord and of other living beings. And thus, by the illusion of Maya, this mentality of lording it over becomes a cause of further extension of conditioned life. So, in the material world, the living being is still more conditioned. Until he surrenders unto the Lord by reviving his original state of eternal servitorship. That is the last instruction of the Bhagavad Gita and all other recognized scriptures of the world. Omeganatam ananda shajananja shakaya chakshurumilitam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri chaitanyamanobishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayam upagramayam dadati swaparantikam. Yeah. So, Hare Krishna. Thank you for sitting here in front of me. So I've been out of action for a few days, And I was actually supposed to give Bhagavatam class on Monday, but that was like no hope, no way. And I got Sachinandana to fill in for me. And then I got, then I was rescheduled for Wednesday, and I got Garanga Prem kindly filled in for me. And I tried to squirm out of this one too. I was hoping Brajapati, but anyway, he had other things conflicting. So, but anyway, the reason how I decided that I was going to do it was after I struck out trying to find somebody to cover for me, I was just relaxing, and this, I don't know if you call it a realization or what, but it came to my mind that I've always assumed that Prabhupada, when he gave class, when he was preaching, was feeling well. I just, you know, that's just always been an assumption in my mind for all the years I've been listening to Prabhupada. Yeah, Prabhupada was probably feeling, he's feeling well. But then I thought to myself, no, wait a second. That's not a very sound assumption. Because, you know, if we review Prabhupada's medical history, you know, Prabhupada, when he, on the boat coming over, he had two heart attacks. And he felt like if he had a third one, that would have been it. I mean, those are his words. And he wrote that in some poem or something, or in his diary. And then within a year, less than a year later, he had a stroke when he was preaching, right, down on the Lower East Side there. So, and he was 70. So really, if you stop and think about it, I mean, a person who's 70 years old, and within the course of a year, had two heart attacks and a stroke, it's very unlikely that every time Prabhupada spoke, he was feeling 100%. But he spoke. So I thought to myself, okay, you know, maybe I shouldn't be such a wimp. And, you know, Prabhupada, I'm sure I'm not, it's a little, you know, not exactly 100% recovered, but I'm sure I'm not experiencing anything like what Prabhupada was experiencing on some occasions when he was speaking. And of course, he always, you know, delivered such great classes. So anyway, so here it's pointed out, Narada Muni speaking, and he's saying how a cow is bound through the nose by a long rope, is conditioned also, so also human beings are bound by different Vedic injunctions and are conditioned to obey the orders of the Supreme. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, Prabhupada says here, every living being, whether a man or an animal or a bird, thinks that he is free by himself, but actually no one is free from the severe laws of the Lord. So what does Prabhupada mean by thinks? In other words, I think it's an existential thinks. In other words, from the, they say it's valid to you know, psychoanalyze somebody from observing the behavior. And I won't go into how I came upon that information, but from the way people live, it appears as if, yeah, they think that they're free. They're free by themselves. They're not controlled by anything. But, you know, really, if you talk to anybody, if you go outside, not devotee, I mean, you just talk to anybody, everybody will agree with you. Everybody will say, yeah, of course. I mean, I understand that you know, we're forced to get old, sick, and die. So everybody, in one sense, in another sense, at least intellectually, everybody will accept that, yeah, I'm controlled, we're controlled. Every living entity is controlled, at least minimally, that we're controlled to get old, we're controlled to get sick, and we're controlled in the sense that we're going to die. And so many other ways too, adiatmic, adibhautic, adidaivic, you know, there's so many different other ways in which we're controlled. And so that's consistent with what's being said in this verse. But what they wouldn't agree with is that there's a supreme behind that control. See, the average person is just thinking, they'll acknowledge, they'll admit, okay, yeah, we're control. That's life. You control. You're forced to get old, you're forced to get sick, et cetera, but there's no supreme behind it. You know, there's no supreme behind it. And their argument would be, how could there possibly be a supreme behind it? You know, supreme has the connotation supreme, like supreme being. Because if there was a supreme behind all this control, how could there possibly be so much suffering? You know, so much suffering, and not just in human society, but in every society, in the society of every living entity, in fish society, in bird society, in plants. There's like, especially these days, when human beings are kind of like out of their mind and they're just kind of like wreaking havoc on every other species that, you know, is on the face of the earth. Whether they, you know, they don't even, anyway. So, you know, probably very few people would agree that there's a supreme behind this. Supreme, why? Because they say, well, what you're saying is, for me to accept that there's a supreme behind this and be, well, simultaneously being aware of all the suffering that's going on in all the different forms of life, you're asking me to accept that there's a being that is benevolent and is, you know, is in control, knows what he's doing. How could you possibly say that? They think that's almost an irresponsible thing for somebody to say. You know, there's a being that's benevolent and competent in managing this whole, behind the management of this whole thing. That's a tough one for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people, and that's why a lot of people are atheists. Now, we're very fortunate in Krishna consciousness because most people don't have the tools. They don't have the ideas to get beyond that. You know, they don't have the ideas to get beyond that. Their worldview is something like this, that, you know, there's molecules, and if you break down the molecules, there's atoms, and when you break down the atoms, you get subatomic particles, and basically, you know, the ultimate basis of reality is these very, very, very small particles, you know, being controlled in electromagnetic fields, and that's it. There's nothing beyond that, behind that, or more than that. There's no meaning, ultimate meaning or purpose to life. It's just, we're here. You know, like you have this expression these days, it is what it is. You've heard that? It's a very popular expression. It is what it is. That's their kind of take on life. It is what it is. This is what it is, you know. But actually, that's an uninformed, that's even a scientifically uninformed understanding. I was very glad to learn that. And how I learned it a couple different ways. I learned it from Judah Karma in that book he wrote, Human Devolution. And then I came across it again in other things I studied up on. And basically it goes like this. That's called physicalism or materialism. It's an expression of, you know, classical physics. Right? But even among those who are in the know of physics, classical physics does a good job of like giving an approximation of the everyday stuff of reality, but it doesn't work. Among the people, the really high level people in physics, they don't go with classical physics as their ultimate understanding of reality. They have quantum physics, which they think enables them to understand things more correctly. And quantum physics is consciousness-based. And I'm not going to try to explain it. I'm not going to go into any details. But take my word for it. Quantum physics is consciousness-based. One of the biggest names in physics, probably second to only Albert Einstein, perhaps, is Max Planck. And he has a very famous quote, "You can't get behind consciousness." See? So in other words, according to those in the know within science, they say that consciousness is the ultimate basis of reality. Now that's interesting. See? We can work with that. Because, you know, getting back to this point of how could you have a supreme controller, you know, that's benevolent and competent, and look what's going on here in this world. Well, the explanation, you know, the way you could have that is the philosophy of Krishna consciousness. You know, with all the different ideas that are presented in the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, you can understand that. I mean, it's just perfect. At least it makes perfect sense on paper. There's a spiritual, you can't get behind consciousness, right? So there's a whole conscious world, you know, a spiritual or world beyond this material world where there's a supreme conscious being, a supreme and eternally conscious living entities that didn't misuse their free will and have to come to this material realm to receive a multi-life educational program. See, we're in a multi-life educational program. And, we're being here, being educated to learn what Prabhupada is describing, you know, here in this purport. So anyway, the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is an answer. You know, it really does give people an alternative to gross materialism, and it even gives people, you know, where to go from just, okay, this consciousness underlying, you know, is the underlying ultimate basis of reality, not matter. In other words, for me, the way I respond to that is, okay, well, then what? Okay, so now what? Consciousness is the ultimate basis of reality. Okay, then what? You know, well, what is the origin of consciousness? And what is our relationship to it? And what is its nature? And, you know, these are kind of, you're getting into the realm of religion. Which brings me to the point, well, I'll give people an update, those who've been following us. About, I don't know, 2 or 3 months ago, I was watching something, and I heard this one person speaking. He was part of a team of scientists that investigates paranormal phenomena and this, with the aim of trying to understand what's the big picture, you know, what's the big story. And I heard this guy say that ultimately he believed that the conclusions they're coming to are occupying moving into some of the same territory as the world's traditional religions. So when I heard him say that, I wrote him an email and I said, well, wait a second. And, you know, I said, you know, when I hear that, that means to me that, you know, the territory of the world's traditional religions is God, his nature, and our relationship with him. And I said, this is exactly what I said in the email. Am I barking up the right tree? And he said, yep, one word email back, yep. So then, so I kept corresponding with him. Finally, I, you know, got to the point where I said, hey, you know, I told him about Judhakarma, and I told him about his book, and I asked him if I could send him a copy. And to my pleasure, he said, yeah. So we sent him a copy, and I got an email back from him yesterday saying that he actually received the copy, he said, but he hadn't had a chance to read it yet. Look at it yet. So I said, okay, wonderful. Thank you for letting me know, and please, I'd be really interested to hear what your thoughts when you, when you've had a chance to look at it. And ultimately, where we're going with this is we're going to try to, you know, if he's favorably impressed by what he reads in that book, Human Devolution, which is great, then hopefully I'm going to try to arrange a meeting between him and Judhakarma. Not just him and Judhakarma, there's like a whole group of them. You know, it's like a whole group of them. I mean, there's a picture and something he sent me. It was about 50 of them, but there's probably more. You know, there's probably a lot of scientists out there, physicists, and, you know, scientifically educated people that are going with this idea that consciousness is the ultimate basis of reality. But and they're looking for the well, what's the rest of the story? And what I'm hoping is Judhakarma is going to be able to come along, you know, give him a copy of that book, and then have him meet Judhakarma. And Judhakarma is going to be able to tell him, here's the rest of the story. Why not? You know, here's what we are going with. You know, and it's the reason is because, blah, 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 you know. And he can give all, you know, the reasons why we are following Krishna consciousness. So that's kind of, you know, what I'm hoping will happen with that. And we'll see. So anyway, I mentioned how we're, we have this, we're in a multiple life re-educational program. And those of us who are here practicing Krishna consciousness, we're getting near to graduating. You know, when you come to the point where you're a devotee, practicing bhakti yoga, you're getting near to graduating. You know, we're close. Prabhupada would, you know, say 16 rounds, 4 good of principles, and like that, going back to Godhead at the end of his lifetime. So that's pretty good. And two thoughts I had. I don't know how I'm going to connect it, but one was that it's a great reward. You know, it's like it's the topmost thing a person could gain. It does require an initial investment of some faith. You got to put a down payment And that down payment is some faith. And but if you do that, it can really pay off big time. One great story about somebody who had some faith. I don't know why. Last night, difficulty sleeping, and just lying there, and that story about the Sakshi Gopal just popped in my head. And I thought to myself, I just said, well, all right, I'm not sleeping, so I might as well get up and read it. And it was really interesting because, you know, that Sakshi Gopal, the deity Sakshi Gopal, was in Vrindavan at the time of this, when this pastime took place. And these two Brahmins, you know, one was like a young, poor Brahmin, and the other was like an older, aristocratic Brahmin. He was wealthy. He had some health issues, apparently. So this young Brahmin, he was assisting him the whole time. You know, now, oh, by the way, Vijayanagar is 600 miles, 1,000 kilometers or 600 miles from Vrindavan. That's long. 600 miles from here is probably Chico? No, further. What's 600 miles from here? Going north, say. Huh? Well, if you go directly north, say like Chico, California, something like that. I don't even think that's 600 miles. But, huh? Yeah, right on the border. You're getting near the border of California. That's a long distance. So anyway, there was quite a pilgrimage. So this young Brahmin was helping him the whole way. And he just felt, the older Brahmin just felt really grateful. He said, you know, he was saying to him, hey, you know, I don't, without your help, I really couldn't have done this. And I want to do something to express my gratitude. You know, I want to arrange for you to marry my daughter. And the young Brahmin said, oh, thank you. I appreciate it. It won't work. You know, I know, you know, I'm a poor, uneducated, whatever, Brahmin, and you're from, you know, a real wealthy, aristocratic family. It's okay, don't worry about it. I appreciate the sentiment, but the older Brahmin insisted. So the younger Brahmin, you know, for Brahmins, truthfulness is a very important thing. They don't just promise things like willy-nilly. And so the younger Brahmin, when the older Brahmin insisted, the younger Brahmin said, well, okay, if you really determined, I mean, if that's what you really, really want to do, you know, then could you please say it in front of the deity here? Because, you know, I mean, so he said, yeah. And he went and took the promise, made the promise in front of the deity. And then, then they left. And they returned to Vijayanagar. And, you know, they just both went their merry ways. You know, the Brahmin went to his ordinary life, and the older Brahmin went to his ordinary life. And after some time passed, the older Brahmin realized, well, I guess I better do something here about the promise I made. So he called a meeting of his friends, well, not friends, family members mostly, maybe some friends, relatives, whatever. And he told them. And they were aghast. They went, are you kidding? You're going to try, and his oldest son was the most, well, his wife threatened to commit suicide. And his oldest son said, you got to be kidding. You know, no way. And the older Brahmin realized, I'm in trouble now. Anyway, the next day the young Brahmin came. It just coincidentally, he came and said, okay, well, you know. And his son drove him away. His son was an atheist. You know, his son drove him away. And it's hard for me to get exact the details, but basically a deal was made that the young Brahmin, because, you know, he asked Gopal to be the witness. And he told the members of the community, and this was witnessed by Gopal Deity, like that. And the young said, and so the young Brahmin proposed in an assembly. They finally, you know, there's like an assembly of the townspeople and everybody. And the young Brahmin said, you know, this was promised before the Gopal Deity. He was a witness. And he will come and he will be witness if necessary. And then the son, the atheistic son, he said, yeah, good. I like that idea. If the Gopal deity witnesses this, then yeah. Because he was confident that no way that's going to happen. So anyway, the young Brahmin went back there. And he's, you know, everybody knows the story, but it's great, such a great story. So he talked to the deity. And the deity said, Vidhi spoke back to him because, you know, this, he had such faith. He was such a, you know, pure devotee. And he, you know, explained to the deity the problem and everything, and that he had the, and he told him, he appealed to him, okay, you know, you got to come and witness. And the deity said, Papa tells it different ways, you know. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, it said that, you know, the Gopal deity said to him, say, well, just go there and remember me in the assembly, and that'll work. And then the Brahmin said, no, they have to see your beautiful face. That's the only way it's going to work. But Prabhupada tells it in a very charming way in a lecture he gives. You know, the Brahmin appealed to the deity, and then the deity said, well, you know, I'm a deity. What makes you think I can walk? And the Brahmin said, well, I mean, you can talk, so I guess you can walk. And, you know, then Prabhupada said, so Gopal was defeated by his logic. So anyway, so you know how the story goes, that they made the arrangement. Gopal made the condition that, yeah, I'll follow you, and you'll know I'm behind you because you'll hear the tinkling of my ankle bells. And, you know, but if you turn around to check and see if I'm really there or not, that's it. And the Brahmin said, okay, no, I'm cool with that, you know, it's all right. So they walked. And I haven't read anything or I haven't heard anything to say that it was anything other than from Davin, because that's where the Gopal deity was at that time, to Vijayanagar, which is 600 miles away. It must have taken him a while. You know, maybe all the people back, the old Brahmin and all the people back in the town were probably figuring this guy died, you know. I mean, because how do you, that's 600 one way and then 600 another way. I mean, there's no mention of how long it took before he got back there again. But anyway, he got back there and all the townspeople, you know, the deity stopped. He didn't hear the tinkling of the ankle bells anymore. And so then at that point, the Brahmin looked around and Gopal said, it's okay. You know, because this is right at the town. They were back basically at Vijayanagar. And the deity said, okay, I'm going to be here. Don't worry. And you can just, you know, do what you got to do. So the Brahmin went and he gathered up all the townspeople and said, okay, here you go. Gopal's here. And that was it for everybody. That was evidence that, you know, yeah, the Gopal deity actually was a witness. Otherwise, how could he be here? You know, it's a big stone deity, you know. And there's no way he could have carried it. I mean, you couldn't even lift it, with the speak of carry it, 600 miles, right? Have you seen it? It's, you know, it's not like a little couple-foot marble deity or something like that. It's a big one. So anyway, so he had some faith, and Krishna reciprocated with his faith. And the more faith we have, the more faith, the more Krishna will reciprocate. And you know, and that's really Krishna consciousness. That's actually, and this is the last point I want to make, that's actually initiation. You know, the first Back to Godhead magazine I got, Judah Karma, I don't know if it was his first one, but he read it too. There was one of those, you know, conversations between Prabhupada and the devotees. And I don't know why this stuck out in my mind, or you know, when I read it then, and just all these years. These two devotees, they asked Prabhupada, when can we become initiated? And Prabhupada said, and this is, you know, right out of the book, I mean out of the magazine, you are already initiated. As soon as one becomes serious to follow my instructions, that is initiation. You see? So when you make that decision to place your faith in what the spiritual master is saying and put it into practice in your life, that's initiation. You know, there's like an exoteric, I'm not trying to undermine the exoteric initiation. In other words, there's an initiation, you know, we have a ceremony and there's a priest and there's a fire sacrifice and there's a spiritual man. That's initiation, right? But this is esoteric initiation. And this is, I think, the more important initiation in the sense that this is the initiation, which will produces transcendental knowledge. And I'll support my statement by quoting the famous verse, tad vidhi pranipatena paripashnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnananas tatvidarshana. So the translation for that, Prabhupada says, just try to learn the truth by approaching a bona fide spiritual master and render service to him. Inquire submissively and render service. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. And in the word-for-word translation, upadekshanti te jnanam means he can initiate you into the truth. See? So in other words, my understanding is that when you make that decision to place your faith in what, you know, the spiritual master, the parampara, is telling us and put it into practice in your life, right, then you're eligible for that upadekshanti te jnanam, to be initiated into the truth. Right? And it's not something that happens at one moment and one point, you know, one place and one... It's not an event. It's a process. And the more you do that, then the more you're going to get initiated into the truth. The more truth you're going to get. You see? So getting back to this other point I was making, that we're really close to graduating. You know, we're all the living entities, not just us. Every jiva that you see out there is in this multi-life re-educational program, and we're in the graduate level here. This is graduate level stuff. I mean, this is PhD stuff. When you come to the Krishna Conscious Movement, you're at the PhD program. Right? Am I right? This is the PhD program. Okay? Yeah. So, be conscious of that. And you just got to keep, you know, rededicating yourself. Rededicating yourself to the philosophy and the process with that faith, like that Brahmin had, that, you know, by doing that, it's all going to be there. So I'll stop there. Probably it's about 8:15. Yeah, okay. I could stop there. Anybody have any question or comment? No? Must have said something wrong. Okay. Thank you very much. Granchoy Chumad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Thank you.